Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen from Black Five sitting in for Frank Gaffney, who is off keeping our electrical grid safe for democracy and from terrorism. We're talking this morning with Andy McCarthy. And Andy is a former federal prosecutor. Andy is also a contributing editor to National Review Online and author of the new book, Faithless Execution, Building the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I am well, but the country is not, and that's why we need to chat. We just arraigned the guy we picked up over in Libya and brought him to the United States for trial. Now, there are so many things wrong with this entire concept. But during the arraignment, I heard something that blew my mind, and I just want to run it by you and make sure I understood it. When they sat him in front of the judge, this judge in D.C. said that he read through the pretrial packet, and then based on the information he was provided, decided at that point to keep him in custody. I mean, that means that there was actually a chance that this judge could have made the opposite decision and let him go free. Is that the way this actually worked?
Well, there is a requirement when you bring someone into the civilian criminal justice system that at his first appearance, which is the usually a presentment on a criminal complaint, the court has to consider and set bail. And that's because when you bring someone into the criminal justice system, the government at least takes the position that the person is entitled to the rights of an American citizen. That's the due process that they're giving them. And under our Constitution and under the rules that apply, that means you're entitled to reasonable bail unless you can be detained under the law. So it can't be just assumed that he would be detained, at least for purposes of the litigation. Now, let me be more complete about how this works. Let's say you have somebody who is an illegal alien who is being detained. That would be shocking, I know.
Yeah, let free, more likely.
Right. But let's say you had an illegal alien who had never been allowed to be free in the country and was being detained, and you found out that he committed a charge beyond the illegal immigration that he's being detained on. If the court would be obliged to set bail for purposes of the case, and if the court, for whatever reason, decided that bail ought to be set, either because the person was not a danger to the community or because the risk of flight was minimal, that wouldn't mean the person would be freed to walk the streets. He would still be detained under immigration charges. Now, the problem with this guy is we were detaining him as an enemy combatant, or if we were, then he would have no right to be released. But it seems we're not detaining him as an enemy combatant. He's being detained as a criminal defendant. So had the judge made this ruling, I don't think it means the guy could have been released, but it would have led to a string of other problems.
I mean, we get the wrong judge. And this could have turned into even a bigger goat rope than it is currently.
Yeah, well, it's not impossible to get the wrong judge either. I mean, this is just the first stage of the proceeding. As I understand it, the case still has to be spun out to a judge, and, you know, then the fun really begins.
What a complete mess. Well, again, I think all this speaks or to the reasoning that lawfare is not the way to deal with terrorism. And unfortunately, our current regime does not agree with that, and they're proving why on a daily basis. Let's talk about some of the other high crimes and misdemeanors, starting at the top and working their way down. Now, currently, the Speaker of the House is threatening to sue the president for all of the various lawlessness, which you detail on a regular basis. You've said that's a horrible idea, and I think obviously, you know, in the separation of powers, it seems to be. But the only alternative is laid out as impeachment of the president or some of his minions. Now, if politically going after Obama is a bad idea, who do you think we've got a good case against?
Well, let's back up for a second. There are two alternatives that Congress has, not just one. One is the impeachment power. You're quite correct about that, and it's not limited to the president. Any officer of the United States, as it says in the Constitution, can be impeached, which means any high official of the executive branch and even any federal judge. We've had impeachments of judges in our history as well. But the main remedy that the framers expected would be used by Congress to rein in executive excess is the power of the purse. You know, if you defund the means that the executive branch has to commit misconduct, it can't commit misconduct. And like, for example, remember we were all afraid that they were going to take these enemy combatants at Gitmo and bring them into the United States. Congress cut off the money. They said that there is no money available to the executive branch to bring enemy combatants into the United States, so they can't do it. They don't have the funds for it. That's the sort of thing that Congress could be doing and should be doing, but hasn't been doing. So that's a big means that they have. Why, you know, for example, we have a Department of Homeland Security that doesn't enforce the immigration laws. Why are we spending billions of dollars on the budget for these immigration agencies that don't enforce the law?
Don't we run into the problem of then the Republicans are shutting down the government again, and they're using, you know, political battles to make us less secure? Can they target that well enough to fight that perception and actually make a difference?
Yeah, I think they could, although you have to worry if the chief strategist thinks that the way to go here is to file a lawsuit, then you have to wonder about the competence that they have to make an argument like that. And, you know, it's quite true that the one time that they actually tried to use their power of the purse, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, and a bunch of House Republicans or House conservatives who tried to defund Obamacare were almost run out of Washington by their own party. You know, it was their own guys who were doing it to them. So obviously they'd have to have a united front, and unfortunately they don't. But what you're talking about, we're talking about the difference here between what could be done legally and what can be accomplished when you don't have particularly good leadership, which is the straits the Republicans find themselves in. I saw that, the recent economic downturn was blamed by the Obama administration. You know, this near, 2.9% contraction in the economy was blamed by the administration on the weather. I'm waiting to see if Boehner's going to file a lawsuit against the weather.
I blame Al Gore. I mean, come on, if we can't blame Al Gore.
Well, it's about as effective as suing the president would be.
Okay, but throw me a bone. How about any of the president's minions? Can we get Holder?
Yeah, sure. You could get Holder. You could look, I think I would start with the IRS if I were in Congress, because, you know, the problem with impeaching the president is while his policies are terribly unpopular, he personally is not as unpopular as his policies.
But we all hate the IRS.
Right. It's a very intensely unpopular agency, and my attitude is, impeach anybody who's been involved in either the original misconduct or the cover-up, throw the case into the Senate, and if the Democrats want to defend the IRS against the American people, then I say let them do it.
Oh, so that smirking guy Koskinen, who Paul Ryan and Trey Gowdy eviscerated, we could go for him? Has he stepped over the line enough we could take a shot at him?
Yeah, well, I think that if you go through his testimony, at many points it seems to me that it was misleading. And the other thing I would note is, and this is a Judicial Watch lawsuit, there's a story in the Washington Examiner a day or two ago that said when the IRS represented to the court that it was merrily making discovery and disclosures to Judicial Watch in a lawsuit, they conveniently left out the fact that they had lost these Lois Lerner emails. So I think they may very well have made misstatements to the federal court in that case as well.
So there you go. The place to act if you want to, because there's plenty of lawlessness going on, but I think the problem is you create a political issue out of what's actually a separation of powers issue by going after the wrong one.
Yeah, well, the other thing, Jim, is that there's a certain paralysis and explosiveness that attends the word impeachment. And I think if we dusted it off and used it against some of these lower officials, it would lose that, and we could use it. It would become what the framers wanted it to be, which was a serious remedy against executive lawlessness.
And I don't expect the Republicans to get their ducks in a line enough on the, well, who knows? We got an election coming up. We may actually see a Senate majority given the way things are going. Do you think there's a play to be made between now and then? I mean, Boehner's lawsuit seems like a political attempt to influence things. Do you think that's what he's using it for?
You know, I feel like I was in a scary place if I thought I could read Boehner's mind. I don't know what he's doing. If he thinks what he's doing is ginning up the base, I think it's going to have the opposite effect, because it's about as feckless a response to what's going on as you can imagine. So if the intention was to get people stirred up, I don't think he got them stirred up exactly the way he intended.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have any more confidence in him as a leader than you seem to, and that's a sad state for the opposition.
He's good for the plaintiff's lawyers, though.
There you go. Well, folks, we've been talking with Andy McCarthy. Andy is a contributing editor to National Review Online and author of the new book, Faithless Execution, Building the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. This is Jim Hansen from Black Five sitting in for Frank and doing some Secure Freedom Radio. We will be back with my good friend Brad Patty to advocate for a free Kurdistan.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, I'm Gary Sinise. It's been 20 years since Forrest Gump, and the story of Lieutenant Dan's triumphant return to normalcy is still a part of my life. I'm honored to share it with the real-life Lieutenant Dan's living among us, the more than 1,700 battle-injured amputees that have returned home since 9/11. As citizens, it's our duty to ensure these heroes get the care they need. Join the Gary Sinise Foundation and help support America's wounded heroes. Visit GarySiniseFoundation.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It is Jim Hansen from Black Five, and I have with me a good friend, Mr. Brad Patty. Brad served on the Iraq Advisory Task Force on the ground during the important years of the surge and the Anbar Awakening, advising U.S. commanders about tribal affairs. And that is actually the part of the war we won and that went well. So it's a pleasure to have you on the show, Brad.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be here.
Well, there's not much good going on anymore. And so I wanted to at least open up and have a discussion with you about whether or not there's anything good we can do. Because I'll let the folks know, we are about to publish, you and I, a piece calling for a free Kurdistan. Now, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Kurdish region obviously is in the north of Iraq. Now, the Kurds live not just in Iraq, but also in neighboring countries, including Turkey and Iran. And for a long time, there was a lot of resistance, especially among the international diplomatic community, to a free, a genuinely independent Kurdish region, because they were afraid it would destabilize Turkey, especially, which is a NATO ally. So the Turks have recently made some noises suggesting that they'd be okay with this, and they're willing to sign contracts on oil and things like that with the Kurds, and, you know, it seems to be working out pretty well. And it would give us a pretty stable base, a place that's U.S.-friendly, a bunch of allies that we could really operate from there and make some good effects in the rest of Iraq, too.
I think the timing of why this is a good idea now is what's really important. The Kurds are the only ones we can help currently.
Well, they're also the only ones we can trust.
True that. We're talking now with Brad Patty, who is a member of the Iraq Advisory Task Force back during the days of the surge, spent 3+ years advising U.S. commanders on the ground. Brad, we're talking about your and my suggestion that Kurdistan's time has come. And recently, there's been a lot of things pointing that way. First of all, the Kurds signed an oil and energy deal with Turkey, and the Turkish government has made noises that they are okay with Kurdish independence, or at least Kurdish self-determination. In addition, Masoud Barzani, president of the Kurdistan region, has said there will be a referendum on self-determination and potentially independence coming up in the not-too-distant future. And Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel went ahead, piped up, and said he thinks that Kurdistan might be a good idea as well. So give me your thoughts on what advantages having a Kurdistan free state in that area right now would be both for the region and especially for the United States.
Well, the Kurdish region would provide a secure operating area if we decide we want to take a more active role in trying to stabilize the conflict, get it to the negotiating table. You can't just sort of drop guys in Baghdad right now, except maybe at the sort of low level that we're looking at. The Baghdad government has repeatedly demonstrated that it's not willing to operate in good faith with the United States or anyone else, especially our former Sunni allies during the awakening. It has broken all of the promises it made to them that we were supposed to be the guarantor of. But the Kurds have always been square with us, and not just us. Actually, you were mentioning the oil deal, and Netanyahu, one reason he's a booster is that their very first shipment out of Kurdistan was 1 million barrels of oil that went to Israel in defiance of the Baghdad government.
You know, I think the advantages you mentioned for certain, and I think another one is just the very idea that if we go ahead and make at least one bold move in the region that isn't a military move, it doesn't involve boots on the ground unless we put them there later, but it's a diplomatic move, it actually shows that we might be a strong horse in the region as opposed to our, you know, current strategy of leading from behind. So I think that right there will put the Syrians, the Iranians, and, you know, there are other folks in the region who may not think we have, I guess, the spine to be a bold player.
Yeah, I mean, even the Russians now are selling fighter jets to the government in Baghdad. And, you know, it's one of those things. If we're going to do something, this is a great place to start because it would give us a secure place to operate out of. And also because the Kurds are, you know, they're the most talented fighters in the area. The Peshmerga were always the most reliable part of the Iraqi army. A lot of it was just Peshmerga that were sort of deputized and put on the uniforms at one point. And, you know, they're a pretty well organized and educated group. I was down on the Euphrates once with a bunch of sheikhs who had come over the river on a footbridge to complain about the fact that the the bridge for road traffic had been cut off by the Iraqi army, which meant they couldn't get to Baghdad to sell their goods. Not that you would have wanted to have driven your car on the roads between there and Baghdad at that time anyway. But, you know, they were claiming this was the case, and they went on through this whole litany of complaints. And the whole time there was this major in the Iraqi army sitting there, this Kurd, and he sort of listened for a long time to the stuff in Arabic that was being then translated to us. And I had, you know, no idea that he understood the English part of the conversation at all. But after about 30 minutes, he suddenly turned to me and, you know, said, "You know they're lying about everything, don't you?"
You know, a straight shooter in that region is hard to come by.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good description.
This seems to be pretty, you know, pretty representative of the Kurds I've encountered. They're good people, and they have a great relationship, especially with the U.S. Special Forces, who operated out of there during the war.
Well, and that's one thing. I mean, you and I were at a journalism fellowship at University of Maryland, and we had Kubad Talabani, member of one of the large, important, almost ruling families of Kurdistan. And when I brought up the 10th Special Forces Group, who were there on the ground keeping the Kurds safe from Saddam, you know, who were enforcing the no-fly zone, the no-drive zone, he almost got teary-eyed, you know, talking about how much they consider 10th Group heroes in Kurdistan because we actually covered their back when Saddam was trying to wipe them out.
Yeah, I agree. We have that relationship with the Kurds, and we had an opportunity to have it with some of the more ancient and noble, if you like, Sunni tribes, the ones who, you know, decided that during the awakening that they were just not going to have any of this Al-Qaeda crap, and it was time to stand up for what they believe in. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of promises got made to them by the government in Baghdad that we sat in as guarantors on, and then when we walked away all of a sudden and all those promises got broken and we didn't do anything about it, it's going to be hard to win back their trust. Guys like the Shamari and the Dulemi tribes, you know, they're good people, but there's no reason that they would trust us or that we could trust them right now.
So, okay, let's say we do this. Let's say the Kurds decide to become independent. We back their play. What impact is that going to have on the Sunni and Shia in Iraq? Is that going to be the wedge that drives that country into three parts?
Possibly. I think we would need to act in some way to try to force a negotiated settlement. It's still possible, maybe, to save the rest of Iraq as a unified entity, if that's something that the people on the ground really want to do. I mean, the citizens of Iraq. But it's going to require the government in Baghdad actually keeping the promises it makes. Right now, there's no trust. There's no good reason for there to be trust between the two parties. And the Sunnis, you know, our awakening allies, may very well prefer to go their own way. And I don't think we can easily blame them if that's what they've decided is necessary, because they've learned they can't trust the government in Baghdad.
And we didn't stay to be that guarantor. I mean, when we cut and ran, when we packed our bags and walked away, we left a totally corrupt Shiite Maliki government with their Iranian allies in charge. And obviously, they've treated Sunnis poorly. They have not operated in good faith. And there was no one there, like you said, to make them. And we're not going to go back and make them. No one else is. You know, the Iranians are the ones who are gaining power. So I don't see how that changes. Is there any reason to believe it will?
No, I think it actually would be to our benefit to some degree to have at least an autonomous Sunni region within Iraq, if not an independent state, to serve as a buffer between Iran and the Levant. That, you know, that's really a better idea than having Iran in control of the borders all the way to Syria.
I think keeping them from being able to march to the sea might be a good idea. Well, folks, we've been talking with Brad Patty about Free Kurdistan. Get on board, get your bumper stickers now before they run out. Coming up next, we will talk with Louis Fleischman about the blatant corruption and bad things happening in Venezuela. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney doing Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
clever adversaries use asymmetric warfare to defeat more powerful foes. Today, even weak enemies can exploit our most obvious and perilous vulnerability. In recent weeks, there have been attacks on the critical infrastructures that generate or distribute electricity. In the Mexican state of Michoacán, a gang shut off the electric grid to facilitate the killing of their rivals. In Yemen, Al-Qaeda shut off the power nationwide. In Arizona, a bomb nearly took out a key transformer substation near Nogales. And a senior Obama administration official has said that reports of sabotage against our grid are a weekly, if not a daily, occurrence. We're on notice. We must take steps now to protect our vital infrastructure against all hazards, or risk an America without power and a world without America. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen from Black 5 sitting in for Frank, who is keeping the electrical grid safe for democracy this week. We are talking this segment with Luis Fleshman, who is a senior advisor to the Center for Security Policy and also co-editor of the Americas Report. And Luis, I wanted to ask you about a piece you wrote regarding the sanctions bill for Venezuela. Obviously, that country has a lot of problems. There are a lot of human rights violations. They support a number of terrorist groups. And they have a huge amount of oil revenue, which gives them a lot of influence. So it's a country we really wish was doing better and potentially not causing as much trouble. And it seems to me that that's what this sanction bill is designed to do, push them in the right direction. And I guess it's passed the House, but is kind of stalled in the Senate. Is that the current status?
Well, that's exactly right. At this point, the Venezuela Defense of Human Rights and Civil Society Act of 2014, that's the Senate version of a bill, which is slightly different than the House one. The House actually passed. And the Senate at this point, as I understand, is being delayed by Senator Bob Corker, who is from Tennessee and a Republican from Tennessee. And it's not clear what the reason is for such delay. But based on the research that I've done and based on different statements, it looks like Senator Corker believes that that could be an interference in the sovereignty and probably not very productive. And secondly, they also believe that there is some sort of sanctions fatigue after imposing sanctions on Iran and Syria and Russia, there is an element of sanctions fatigue. I, of course, reject both arguments very respectfully so. First of all, because those sanctions are not the sort of embargo that is being imposed on Cuba and are not the sort of sanctions that are being imposed on Iran, not even on Russia.
So give us some specifics then. What would this specifically be doing to push the Venezuelans?
This bill targets individuals involved in violations of human rights. And these are individuals. It's not the people of Venezuela, and it's not even the government of Venezuela, which deep down we all know it's mainly responsible for the violations of human rights. These are individuals involved, and there is a list, and this list is growing. I mean, Senator Marco Rubio, presented some of the names on that list. And in fact, what it does is basically personal sanctions, is freezing of assets and not allowing them travel visas to the United States. Many of those people who are associated with Chavez have free access to, with the government of Venezuela, Chavez is no more, have free access to the United States. Some of them are willing, are living tremendous, opulent lives even here in Florida, where I'm calling you from, in Palm Beach County. Even people who are associated with the drug traffic actually have either accounts in the United States or some sort of asset or free access. So that's all it is. And what the importance of those sanctions at this point is to send a clear message to the Venezuelan government that violations of human rights are not to be tolerated. Because at this point, Latin American governments, for instance, simply do not care. They see they see pressure on Venezuela to ease, to ease on human rights or to stop violating human rights as an interference in the sovereignty. And all of them, in a way or another, supported the Maduro government. The United States is the first step taken by the United States aimed at restoring law and order. It's not even about regime change. This is not about regime change. This is about putting pressure on the Maduro government to restore the rule of law and democracy.
So these people we have on the list, we know who they are. They're members of criminal elements. They may have ties to drug traffickers. Do we know if any of them are potentially involved? Obviously, Venezuela previously has had ties to Hezbollah and some of the other terrorist groups. Do we have any idea that some of these people might be involved with those kind of things as well?
Well, I do not know, and this is a very good question. I don't know how to answer this question, but definitely the Venezuelan government has had relations with Hezbollah and with Iran. Even Venezuelan diplomats, obviously, with the green light of the Venezuelan government, have been involved in connecting the Venezuela, in basically being liaisons between the Venezuelan government and members of Hezbollah. And that included training of Venezuelans, and that including also facilitating the movement of money that benefited Hezbollah under the protection of the Venezuelan government. So the relation with Iran and Hezbollah is there, and definitely is very dangerous to our security, which is another reason for the United States to be involved in what is going on in Latin America. I'll give you an example. I mean, there have been a couple of reports claiming that the Iranians have placed missiles on the Paraguaná Peninsula, which is in the northern part of Venezuela. Now, these reports actually have two different sources, never been confirmed by any American source, by any American government, but it has not been denied either. This is a serious issue. Potentially, the alliance of two radical regimes a couple of hours away flight from our territory is definitely dangerous, and we need to think in advance, particularly in a world like today. Look at what is going on in Iraq and Syria today. We failed miserably to anticipate the events there, and I don't think everything is taking us by surprise.
Well, that seems to be a common theme.
One day, Latin America will take us by surprise, and And so a good foreign policy establishment needs to think about all the possibilities.
Okay, so sanctions is one, and it seems, you know, I guess they're stalled now, but I hopefully we can re-energize them. What else can we do in the region to regain some influence? I mean, we've obviously kind of taken our eye off the ball in our own neighborhood. You know, if you look at Central and South America, both, we've had almost no emphasis on that. So aside from sanctions in Venezuela, where else should we be trying to reestablish some American influence and regain some friends in the region?
Jim, it's interesting that you ask this question, and I'm very, very grateful to you for asking, because I laid out those parameters in my book that was published a year ago, Latin America in the Post-Chavez Era, The Threat to the U.S., you know, a book that is published by Potomac and still remains relevant. The United States needs to think beyond trade and economics, needs to think in terms of establishing alliances with those people who are willing to promote democracy, and to be more vocal in promoting democracy. At this point, even democratic countries in Latin America are, in a way or another, supporting the government of Venezuela. And, of course, they have revived also Cuba. Cuba, again, is like a normal country and even influential in the area. Latin American countries, even though Brazil, which is a growing economy and a growing democracy, they have been the biggest enablers of the government of Venezuela. And they continue to be, you know. It's not just the Cubans, it's also the Brazilians, because there is an affinity between governments of the left. Nobody there is speaking for democracy. The Democratic Charter of the Organization of American States has been totally forgotten. Nobody is demanding from Venezuela to restore democracy. So the United States must bring to the continent the importance of democracy, has to take the lead and be more aggressive in discussing these issues, particularly with countries such as Brazil, because economic relations between Brazil and the United States are very good. I mean, I live here in Florida. I can tell you the amount of Brazilians and the amount of Brazilian investments. The United States has to use its leverage and try to persuade Brazil to work in the direction of democracy, and to work with other countries and bring that to the table. None of this has been done so far.
Well, Luis, hopefully some folks will read your book and follow that advice, because it sounds good from my end, and I hope the rest of the U.S. government will follow that lead and work in the region to gain some allies and some friends and some influence. Folks, we've been talking with Luis Fleshman, who is a senior advisor for the Center for Security Policy, as well as co-editor of the Americas Report. Thanks for being with us, Luis.
Thank you.
Next up, we'll be talking with Michael Rubin, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and author of Dancing with the Devil, A History of U.S. Diplomacy with Rogue Regimes and Terrorist Groups.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families,
including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Any soldier. It could be your father, your sister, your neighbor, or your best friend. Or it could be someone like this soldier who writes, quote, "This is a great thing you are doing here. Keep up the good work." AnnieSoldier.com has become synonymous with goodwill and great stuff. The troops really appreciate the effort. Take care and thanks again. End quote. Log on to www.AnnieSoldier.com and find out what you can do to help our deployed men and women in the armed forces.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, folks. This is Jim Hansen from Black Five sitting in for Frank Gaffney. We have the pleasure of Michael Rubin joining us. Michael's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, as well as the author of Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engagement, which talks a lot about some of the, I guess, the malefactors around the world we sometimes deal with well and poorly. Michael, let's talk about the biggest mess going on right now, which is Iraq. And we seem to have stirred the pot, left, and now are reaping the rewards of putting some fairly unpleasant people in power to replace a very unpleasant person. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts of the current folks running Iraq and our part in I guess, putting them there?
You know, Jim, I'm of mixed mind on this because while a lot of people say, hey, look, it's Prime Minister Maliki and his sectarianism which has caused this problem, I tend to see terrorism, at least when it comes to the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, more through the lens of ideology than simply through the lens of grievance. Even if Maliki were a little bit nicer, even if he hadn't fired and tried to prosecute Tariq al-Hashimi, the former vice president, that was neither here nor there where Daesh was concerned. When it comes to this idea of groups which want a caliphate, we do need to recognize that there's no compromising with them, no matter what the problems in Iraq are. But that said, the Iraqis certainly recognize that Maliki hasn't been an adequate manager, and already they're working to replace him. What I fear is that the Americans, by insisting so much, are going to delegitimize who comes next when the Iraqis are already on the way to kicking the man out the door.
Yeah, and I think you make a very fair point that there really is no compromise with the kind of folks who run up the black flag and who now have declared a caliphate. So whether or not Maliki treated the Sunnis poorly, those people were going to have a beef. But what about the Sunni tribal leaders who we actually had a decent working relationship with, you know, during the time we spent of the surge, the Anbar Awakening, the Sons of Iraq? There were some relatively moderate Sunni leaders who trusted us and who believed that we would stay and kind of manage the relationship between them and the central Iraqi government, you know, which has an obvious Iranian leaning. Did we just lose any credibility with them and ability to influence that situation by walking away from it?
Well, ultimately, I think you really put your finger on it. We did walk away from it. Part of the problem in Iraq, by the way, is that if you ask any Iraqi group what their proportion of the population is, Iraq is the first country that has 258% of its own population. But you're absolutely right. You know, we predicated our withdrawal on the fact that we would, A, still have influence politically inside Iraq. That was false. That we could provide security from over the horizon. That was false. And what really happened in Mosul was an intelligence failure of the first order for Iraq's second largest city to fall and us not know about it until it happened. And third, that the Iraqi military was trained enough and professional. What worries me is we are predicating our withdrawal from Afghanistan on the same principles, that we're still going to have influence, that we're going to be able to provide over-the-horizon security, and that the military is up to snuff. And unfortunately, when I see Iraq, I look at a crystal ball for Afghanistan.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. That's likely to turn into a bigger mess. Unfortunately, though, Iraq happens to be in a much more strategically vital area. And we've got an awful lot of reason to care what's going on there, because if Iraq turns into a place where the Iranians are the main power broker and they can move from Iran across Iraq to Syria to the Mediterranean, we've got a pretty big problem in an area where we used to be a fairly big influence and no longer are seen as the strong horse.
When it comes to national security in the United States, the biggest difference between left and right is the left always demonizes power while the right sees that it can be used for good or bad. President Obama has also fundamentally misunderstood the importance of the U.S. military and a strong U.S. military. He sees it as an arrow in our quiver, as a policy option to engage in a war of choice. He doesn't understand that having the strongest military on earth was literally having our finger in the dike, preventing a deluge of chaos. And by withdrawing our finger, ultimately, this is why we're seeing ISIS rise up like they never could have before in Iraq. This is why we see Russia in the Ukraine, China saber-rattling in the South China Sea, and so forth.
Yeah, and I think the power of deterrence is really the biggest raison d'etre for the U.S. military. I mean, if you use your diplomacy well, you still have to have that iron fist inside the velvet glove so that people are looking at you and not making bad decisions, because they know if they do, we'll bring the pain. And we've taken that option more or less off the table. I don't think anyone believes in any of those areas that there's any chance of U.S. intervention. Consequently, they've lost the fear of doing that. Given the fact that we no longer are the power broker, the Russians just delivered jets to Iraq, what can we do to influence the current situation?
Well, ultimately, one thing which is very attainable, and I'm surprised we haven't done it yet, is when I've talked to security officials from Morocco through Iraq and into Europe as well, almost everyone says that most of these international jihadis who are going into Syria to fight for ISIS or, and then from there perhaps into Iraq, are crossing into Syria from Turkey. They're flying to Istanbul, taking a regular domestic Turkish Air flight to either Hatay or Gaziantep, paying $40 to cross the border. The fact of the matter is, Turkey's got to stop playing these double games when it comes to these really, truly militant jihadis.
Do they have to check their AKs at the gate when they get on those flights?
With Turkish Air, you never know what they're doing, because remember, Turkish Air was implicated in one of these taping scandals where you had the chairman of Turkish Air complaining to Erdogan that he didn't feel comfortable shipping the arms to Nigeria like the Turkish government was having him do. And this was right before the rise of Boko Haram. And what the chairman of Turkish Air said was he was afraid these arms would be used against Muslims instead of Christians.
Let me ask you a question. We had a friend of mine on earlier in the show talking about Kurdistan. And right now, we are not going to make a big military presence. We are not going to be the power broker in any legitimate way between the Sunni and the Shia. I don't see it happening. I don't think Obama's got it in him. But right now, our good friends, you mentioned Erdogan in Turkey, the Kurds just signed a 50-year energy deal with Turkey. They're shipping oil to them. Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, who took shipment of some Kurdish oil not too long ago, has said that he believes they should have an independent state. And President Barzani in Kurdistan has said there's a referendum coming up. What are your thoughts about them running their flag up for real and becoming a free state?
You know, emotionally, I think they should. I have no problem with Kurdish independence. What my concern is, we need to recognize this. Kurdistan will be a small country surrounded by much larger countries, and Kurdish officials are not united. This gives an opening to others to play games inside Kurdistan. The other thing we need to recognize is that the Kurds, while they are they roll out the red carpet for Americans, their security forces are very, very close to the Iranians. And the Americans have had a problem in the past with the Kurds transferring information, which was told to them in confidence, to the Iranians. That ultimately is going to be a problem with which we need to deal. The Kurds have developed a strong relationship with Turkey, an economic relationship, but in order not to put all their eggs in one basket, they've also been trying to have and encourage a greater opening to Iran. So we do need to recognize that it's not only the Shiites in Iraq that are under Iranian influence, but many of the Kurds as well.
Real quickly here, do you think we could potentially, in a deal like this, if we back them and give them recognition, obtain some basing rights and give ourselves a little foothold with someone we can trust more than most of the other players in the region?
Absolutely. It would be a very good idea if we would do that. Ultimately, though, I have doubts that our president thinks in terms of a global strategy. So let's hope that perhaps his successor will think about doing that.
Michael, I fear that you've hit the nail on the head. We can have the best ideas in the world, but the guy implementing them right now does not fill me or anyone else with any confidence. We've been talking with Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and author of Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engagement. This is Jim Hansen. I've been sitting in for Frank doing Secure Freedom Radio.
From the nation's capital.